I'm Chris Sidorek, and this is a special hour of Radio Boston. As we head into the July 4th holiday weekend, we want to bring you some pure summer joy. We know that the pandemic hasn't gone away, and we all have to take appropriate care, but we can hopefully still enjoy the summer. And what's more joyous, not to mention more July 4th, than the Boston Pops? Of course, that didn't happen on the Esplanade last year. And it was the first time in 25 years that Keith Lockhart did not conduct the Pops for the July 4th extravaganza. So last year, Radio Boston's Tiziana Deering
crying
asked
into
him
my
where
beer
he'd be on the 4th. This year, however, Keith and the entire Boston Pops are back. There'll be the traditional fireworks spectacular on the Esplanade, but the Pops will perform in Tanglewood for a reduced crowd. But it's their first live audience and Tanglewood's first live show since the pandemic. We checked in with Keith as he was preparing for the performance, and I started by asking him how he's doing and whether he'd been right about how he'd spend the last 4th of July.
Well, that proved to be prescient, because indeed I was crying into my beer for most of the 4th of July. I did spend it with some friends up in New Hampshire and tried really hard not to think about how I'd spent the last 25 of them.
Yeah,
I'm doing okay. I mean, as you know, it's been a extremely difficult year for performing artists, not only in practical matters like, employment, but also just spiritually, because, you know, what we're all about is engaging with audiences. And it's been well nigh impossible, even with, you know, all the virtual efforts we've made. There's still nothing like actually being able to connect with people live. On the other hand, it's an upbeat kind of time because we're seeing things changing. They're slower than I'd like to be, but nonetheless, they seem to be going in the right direction.
So I do want to focus on that for just another minute. For folks who aren't in the performing arts, how would you characterize what was lost over the last 15, 16 months for you and your musicians?
Well, for us, it was the ability to do what we do. I mean, the basis of our profession, our professional lives, our employment, but on top of that, also just our spirits and our souls are about live performing arts, which have to do with not just playing your instrument, but playing your instrument for people and being there in a real-time shared emotional experience. And it's very hard to describe how this is something that I've done, pretty much every week you can imagine since I was 18 or 19 years old. And all of a sudden to have a year and a half of your life in which that's not even a possibility is something that I don't think any of us imagined. I think, you know, the greater thought is, though, you know, what has been lost over this period of time for all of us. And I think it's that sense of community, that sense of congregation and engagement. And I hope that people are very desperate to regain that, and that it really hurts to not be able to share these experiences with our fellow humans, because that's, of course, what we need to be able to bounce back. We need an audience to bounce back with us.
I'm curious, as we are hopefully starting to move out of this and return to something that resembles a new normal, is there anything from the last 15, 16 months that you want to keep? Any lessons learned or opportunities that maybe were outside the box, hadn't been thought of before the pandemic, that you'd like to hold on to as we reopen?
Well, there are. I mean, you know, we all grasp desperately for silver linings, but I think there are a couple. One is that performing arts organizations, especially orchestras, were very much 19th century sort of creatures. And we've learned an awful lot about online engagement, about virtual presentation of our product. We had to pivot rather quickly to, you know, producing videos as opposed to producing concerts. And I think we've learned a lot about how to do that. And though, as I said, it's a poor substitute for actual live engagement, at least it allows us to get the message out more broadly and to, a wider swath of potential audience members. And I think going forward, we're going to see that used as a tool along with simultaneously side by side with live performance. I have a feeling that our concert hall will always be expanded that way, and that's a good thing. I think another good thing is that our approach, at least at the Boston Symphony and the Boston Pops, was to ask our players to engage with the audience one at a time. And there were so many homemade videos of people practicing in their basements and playing for and with their kids and that sort of thing. And I think the audience, we tend to market the path of least resistance, which is to put the conductor's face on the brochure. And I think the audience has a much better idea of who those other 100 people on that stage are now than they did before. And if I may, I think the third thing is, I think I will never again take what I've been blessed to be able to do for a living for the last 35 years or so. I don't think I'll ever be able to take it for granted again. I will always be so deeply grateful to actually be able to put on concert clothes and walk onto a stage that it's going to be hard to have a grumpy day.
What is it about the live audience that makes it a different experience, do you think?
There's a couple of things, and they're kind of hard to put your finger on directly, because so much of it is really kind of a visceral reaction. It's amazing that, you know, as you know, as a conductor, I'm very used to performing with my back to the audience. You know, as a instrumental performer, I had many more opportunities to face the audience. But you can always tell an audience is there. You can tell an audience is with you. You can sense their presence, and they actually do affect and shape the performance. And there's a practical side to this too. Our art, specifically orchestras, orchestral music, whether it's the Boston Pops or the Boston Symphony playing Mahler, is about that live engagement. If you just want to tell somebody, if somebody says, I really want to see a video performance of Pick a Piece, Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, I can direct you to YouTube, and there are many fine, fully filmed performances of that symphony there. But the point of music is seeing it be made, seeing the sweat, understanding that these dots on a page are only a beginning, and there's a wide variety of interpretive nuance that is brought to that. And by being there, being a part of that score being realized. And that's where, you know, from our point of view as performers, we really need to get back to touching people one at a time, or 1,000 at a time, or in the case of the 4th of July, 500,000 at a time.
I want to come back to something we talked to you about last year. Last year, July 4th, we were a couple of months out from George Floyd being killed. There were protests and demonstrations across the country, and we talked about the complicated nature of July 4th as we become more honest about our own history. And that obviously holds true more than ever this year. And I want to play a little bit of sound for you. This is from an interview we did recently with Reverend Mariama White Hammond, a pastor at New Roots AME Church in Dorchester, talking about July 4th and what it means from an honest perspective.
Just sort of celebrating July 4th and saying, you know, we should all just fit into that, misses the fact that the history of this country is complex for a lot of us, and that July 4th wasn't real freedom for a lot of us. That while some people were celebrating their freedom, some of us were, our ancestors were working the fields.
Our federal government just recently recognized Juneteenth as an official holiday a few weeks ago. How are you thinking about that? And does the meaning of July 4th, has that changed at all for you over the nearly three decades you've been a part of the celebration?
This has really been this year, and I think I'm not just saying that because I've been lucky enough or unlucky enough to be here for it, has been so transformative. Either of these events, either the pandemic or the really heightened, for the first time in years to this level, awareness of the flaws within our system and their real life impact on people who supposedly enjoy the protections of being an American. These two things coming together has really created a fascinating energy surge. The Juneteenth acknowledgement of the fact that July 4th perhaps doesn't tell the entire story is, I think, a solid one, a positive one, and one going in the right direction. I think it's important, though, when we do this concert historically, not just in this year, not last year, right in the wake of the George Floyd killing, but all the way through. I mean, we've done in the last 25 years that I've been doing this concert, we've, you know, done it right after 9/11, months after 9/11, we've done it. It was the first big public gathering after the marathon bombing. There's all sorts of moments like that that make you understand that it is appropriate to celebrate on the 4th of July. But what's not appropriate is to stick your fingers in your ears and sing patriotic tunes and ignore what is around you. What I believe the message we always try to send, and this year will be no exception, and probably that message will be sent a little more strongly, is that what we celebrate on the 4th of July is an ideal. It's a dream. It's something that was set into motion on the 4th of July. And no, it was not set into motion for everybody who was supposedly covered by it at that point. And that what the 4th of July has to be, rather than just a rah-rah wave the flag moment, is a celebration of pride in being an American and a recommitment to what it truly should mean to be an American in terms of ensuring that the rights that we celebrate apply to all Americans.
So I want to turn to this year's July 4th show. I covered many of your performances down on the Esplanade over the years and kind of became very familiar with some of the beats of the performance and the vibe of the show. Can you tell us a little bit about what folks should expect this year? I believe it's a reduced crowd. You're going to have about 9,000 folks at Tanglewood. What should folks expect if they're coming live or if they're going to tune in on TV or streaming?
Well, yes, we are at 9,000 people. That is the capacity limit for the year for this summer set at Tanglewood by the municipalities, Stockbridge and Lenox, whose grounds of Tanglewood sit between. We would love to be out at full capacity there, but that's not going to happen this year. Nonetheless, 9,000 people feels a lot more than zero people. So we definitely feel like we're moving in the right direction. I think the concert this year, I hope that it will have a lot of things that ring familiar and true to people. I mean, one of the reasons for traditions and celebration is that feeling of going back and being able to say, well, at least that's still here. And I think we all need that, perhaps more than ever. We have, great patriotic music and the bookends of the concert, the Star Spangled Banner, Stars and Stripes Forever, patriotic sing-along.
Are you going to have the confetti, really, is what I'm asking.
I don't honestly know the answer to whether we're going to have the confetti. But what I do know is that we have John Baptiste coming and joining us, which I was just over the moon about. And then we have Mavis Staples, who's just really an R&B legend. And, and some fun country bluegrass stuff with the Six String Soldiers and a great chorus in the Air Force's Singing Sergeants. I try to make sure that this concert is for everyone who's likely to tune in, that nobody goes, this concert isn't for me, because, the whole idea of this holiday is supposed to be bringing people together in things that they can commonly celebrate.
That's Keith Lockhart, conductor of the Boston Pops Orchestra. Keith, I know you said last year you didn't know what to do with yourself having July 4th off. I hope you didn't get used to it, because you're back on the job this year.
I was like so sad that I didn't know what to do with myself. And now I'm going to be like, wow, I really should have enjoyed that moment more while I had it.
That's right. Thanks so much for joining us again, Keith. Really appreciate the time.
Thank you, Chris. Take care. Happy 4th.
Stay with us. Coming up, summer blockbusters are another seasonal source of joy for so many. And after a year of studios holding films due to the pandemic, there is a lot to choose from this summer. We'll pick out some highlights and talk about what streaming could mean for theaters and the film industry as a whole moving forward. I'm Chris Siderick, and this is Radio Boston. Today we're celebrating summer joy as we head into the July 4th holiday weekend. Just before the break, we heard from Keith Lockhart. He's preparing to conduct the Pops at Tanglewood for the 4th in front of 9,000 people, the first live performance at Tanglewood and the first live performance for the Boston Pops since March 2020. Movie theaters are also hoping for a return this summer, and with that summer tradition, the blockbuster.
No matter how fast you are,
I am not to be compared to you.
No one outruns their past.
I am more easy, you trying your best to become me.
And mine just caught up to me.
That's from F9, the latest in the Fast and Furious franchise, which opened last weekend to the tune of $70 million, the biggest opening weekend for a film since 2019's Rise of Skywalker. With so many films slated for release this summer, I sat down with Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr and Ali Johnson, film critic for CambridgeDay.com and editor-in-chief for TheYoungFolks.com, to talk about what's exciting them and what movies will be like after the pandemic. Ty started with F9's opening weekend performance.
I think it's encouraging. I mean, it's still low compared to pre-pandemic levels. A Fast and Furious franchise movie generally breaks 100 million. I think you are seeing people cautiously coming back to theaters. I think you'll see that, increase. Those numbers will climb up as the studios start rolling out things that they were, holding back. Black Widow, which we're going to talk about, was supposed to come out May of 2020. It's coming out July of 2021. So there's a backlog there. But I also think that almost all the movies we're talking about today are showing up in theaters simultaneously with a streaming debut. Not F9, not the big, franchise things, although some of them as well. So that may impact box office numbers, or may not. I don't know. Remains to be seen.
Before I move on, I am curious, because with F9, according to Variety, 51% of the ticket buyers were under the age of 25. And if you break it down demographically, 37% of those who went to see it opening weekend were Hispanic, 35% Caucasian. The director says it's basically due to the diverse cast. I'm curious, how important do you think it's going to be for movies going forward to feature diverse casts and to aim their films at a diverse audience?
I mean, I feel very important, but I also think I would have said that a year or two ago also, and it's just that Hollywood tends to move its, progresses very slowly in terms of representation, but hopefully they'll see that through the releases of films like F9 and having that diverse cast, especially, or like something like In the Heights even, which didn't necessarily do wonderfully, but certainly encourage people to get back to the theaters. I feel like Hollywood tends to take like the wrong messages from films that do well, but I'm hoping they take the right one in this case, where they see that diverse casting will help bolster like a community-like feeling of people going back to the theaters.
Yeah, I'm curious. It's interesting because we've seen in the last few years, especially, you've had some of these films, Black Panther, Crazy Rich Asians, Jordan Peele kind of making a name for himself in this world of black horror. I'm wondering if it is safe to say this is now a trend as opposed to kind of these one-off mainstream successes.
I think as these movies find an audience and make money, the people who greenlight movies sit up and pay attention and try and replicate that. That's the history of the film industry, basically. I do think it's interesting that they are hiring indie directors to direct blockbusters now. So Chloe Zhao, who just won an Oscar for Nomadland, is directing a superhero movie, The Eternals. That's just one example of many. So I do think that they are experimenting on a number of fronts. And I do think that they're certainly aware of what having a diverse cast and a diverse crew, in front of them, behind the camera, how that can A, replicate the real world, and B, draw in larger audiences and more diverse audiences.
All right, I want to shift gears here. Let's talk about some of the highlights you two are both looking forward to this summer. And why not start with one that is out today?
We wanted progress. We are black people and we should be proud of this.
We were coming together to say this was our world and how beautiful it was.
We're gonna try to sing a song together. Don't wait for your neighbor, because your neighbor might be waiting for you.
Wanna take you higher? Are you ready? Wanna take you higher?
We believed in what we felt in here. So when we went up, let's go. Let's go do it.
All right, so this is Summer of Soul. This is a documentary produced by Questlove, the drummer for The Roots, talking about the Harlem Culture Festival in August 1969. I mean, just looking at the lineup of musical acts that are going to be featured in this, Stevie Wonder, Nina Simone, Sly and the Family Stone, Gladys Knight and the Pips. Safe to say we all can be excited for this one, but why are you guys excited to see this? And Ty, I believe you've actually seen this already. Tell us a little tell us more about the film.
So this is This was actually videotaped in summer of 1969. The festival took place over 6 weekends, so it's not all on the same weekend. And it was never made into a movie, and it basically sat in cans for 50 years until Questlove heard about it. He directed it. He didn't just produce it, he directed it. And I have to say, this movie is edited brilliantly, not just the musical acts, but the cuts between the audience, the talking heads, the archival stuff from what's going on in 1969. It's a hell of a ride, and the music, the acts are just insanely good. You've got Stevie Wonder at 19, like between little Stevie Wonder and you know, maturity with Talking Book. You've got Sly and his Family Stone just completely tearing up the stage. You've got Nina Simone. You've got Mahalia Jackson duetting with Mavis Staples, which will just set your hair on fire. Gladys Knight and the Pips. God, who isn't in this thing? David Ruffin singing My Girl. It's just, it's a phenomenal movie. In my mind, it's instantly a classic rock documentary.
Yeah, and I wonder also if, like, for me, a reason to be excited is to kind of just see that energy, even though I might not be the place where I would be going to a music festival or anything, but to kind of capture that essence as well on film, especially right now. I wonder if that kind of changes people's perspective into seeing it for the first time.
Yeah, standing kind of elbow to elbow with thousands of other folks throughout the crowd. I was actually reading that Questlove picked the footage for the documentary from just watching a 24-hour loop of footage of this concert, basically nonstop. Everywhere he went would be watching footage, and had more than 3 hours that basically had to cut down to two. Ty, you mentioned this was a six-week extravaganza, basically. How do you make a film about that and tell that story in a compelling way?
Well, each weekend was a different kind of genre of music. There was a gospel weekend, there was a jazz weekend, there was a soul weekend. But it's really not, it's about the music, but it's more about the community. And it's more about Black America in 1969, not long after Martin Luther King was shot. They talked to people on the weekend of the moon landings who are saying, great, we put a man on the moon. Let's put some money into Harlem, please. You get a sense of, and people talk about this, and they interview people now who were at the festival 50 years ago as, you know, teenagers. And they talk about this as a very pivotal moment when sort of the civil rights era was giving way to a more revolutionary time of the Black Panthers. And the movie takes place really at that pivot point. And you see it in the dress, you hear it in the music, you hear it in what people are saying. So it's not just a snapshot of the music or the culture. It's a snapshot of America, of Black America.
Yeah, Ali, you mentioned amplifying diverse voices through film. And obviously, I think so many folks know what Woodstock was. I think a much smaller percentage of people would know what the Harlem Culture Festival was. Yet this footage sat for decades and is just now, the story is now finally being told. How important do you think it is to bring stories like that to the mainstream?
I mean, I think it's crucial for viewers to have that experience, because I feel like one of the best things about film is that it builds empathy, because you're seeing like a worldview that you might not have seen before, or you're experiencing something that maybe like this you never heard of. And I think part of what would be great about kind of continually getting these type of stories and these diverse voices is the fact that maybe, you know, somebody who isn't a huge film person will still stumble upon it. And again, it's like their worldview just opens up a little bit larger. So I think crucial is the way I would put it. I think we need a significant amount more of it. And I think with films like Summer of Soul, it's a incredible step in the right direction of kind of putting into the mainstream what should have been there for decades.
All right, I want to dig into another documentary coming out this month, and that's Roadrunner, a film about Anthony Bourdain. That'll be released July 16th. Now, this one obviously focuses on the life of Anthony Bourdain, the chef, author, world traveler. And I think Anthony himself kind of sums up the movie in this clip from the trailer.
One minute I was standing next to a deep fryer, and the next I was watching the sunset over the Sahara. What am I doing here? I said earlier that I was going to tell you the truth. This is part of it.
It was almost never about food. It was about Tony learning how to be a better person.
I think people can't get enough of Anthony Bourdain. And I think that a lot of people are still in some real way mourning him. He was such a vibrant, vivid personality. He seemed like such a good guy from his writing and from his travel show. And his suicide really just knocked people over. And there's a void in the culture that he filled, just in terms of bringing people to different cultures, cuisines, experiences with an openness that was just really enjoyable to share. And I think one reason that this movie is going to be, it's being made by Morgan Neville, who made 20 Feet from Stardom and Won't You Be My Neighbor, is that I think it's going to be pretty successful because we miss the guy. We miss his personality.
Yeah.
And I think from what I've seen of the trailer, I haven't seen it, it seems pretty direct in dealing with his issues of depression and his struggles with becoming famous, which I think is good that they're doing that.
Yeah, the opening of the trailer is essentially Anthony Bourdain's own voice saying, spoiler alert, this does not have a happy ending. You touched on Bourdain died by suicide in 2018. I just want to, we always put out anytime we're talking about these issues, if you or a loved one have thoughts of suicide, there is a suicide hotline, 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255. I imagine that presents a big challenge for a filmmaker to tell Anthony Bourdain's story. Folks are going to go in and the big question that we're always faced with when we lose someone this way is why? And I don't think that's something you can answer in this movie. Can you talk a little bit about that tension and that what the viewing experience is going to be like for folks who, like you said, Ty, this is a guy that I think a lot of us still miss.
I've seen the film, and I think maybe one of the strongest components of it is the fact, and maybe one of the things that will be the most startling to people, is the fact that you almost forget while watching it that he wasn't like an active part of making it, aside from it being about his life. Like, it almost makes you forget that he's gone. And I think that's a testament to the filmmaking. But I think, again, I think it speaks to how larger than life his personality was, and like Ty said, kind of the void not being filled. But I wonder if it will kind of give people who are still kind of mourning him that sense of closure, or if it will just, to me, I felt like I just missed that presence more at the end of
that's,
it.
That's such a perfect way to put it, because I feel like in this moment where we have just been through one heck of a 16 months here, struggling through this pandemic, we've talked about systemic racial inequity and justice and all of these really heavy, difficult things that we are dealing with as a society. And Anthony Bourdain seemed like the kind of person who could reach out and connect with people on a human level. And it feels like that's so much of what we need right now. Is that, do you think, part of why he's so missed?
Yeah, I think it is. It's like he gave us that window of empathy towards the world and compassion in a way that I don't see a lot of either talk show hosts or travel narrators tackling in the same way. I think people try. I just think there was something specific about him that kind of felt regular, like your average day guy, mixed with this kind of like overflowing amount of empathy that just made him kind of a beacon for people who needed that sense of comfort.
Yeah, I should add that will air on CNN and HBO Max at some point after its theater release. We don't have a date for that yet. Okay, we can't talk summer movies without talking about a superhero blockbuster, and we are due for one of those. Ty, you mentioned this. Marvel's Black Widow is coming out.
At some point, we all have to choose between what the world wants you to be and who you are. I made my choice. I'm done running.
This is really fascinating because I think Marvel is looking to take things to the next phase. So let me start by just saying, are you guys superhero movie fans, and are you looking forward to this one as much as I am?
To be blunt, no.
I thought that might be the answer, Ty, to be honest.
I like the good ones. I like the good ones, the ones where you can tell they're having fun, where they bring in a interesting director like Taika Waititi with the third Thor movie, or Rian Johnson with the second to last Star Wars film. But in general, the franchise thing just kind of leaves me cold. But I understand I'm in the minority there. how about you, Allie?
So I grew up a big superhero fan, especially of like DC animation. So I still have like a draw to it. And there is definitely time in the last now decade or so where I was, they weren't my favorite films, but I had a lot of fun going to the theater and experiencing them. But I am at the point of burnout. And it's a shame that I'm at the point of burnout when they're finally telling more diverse and interesting stories.
So this is also one of those films, Ty, that you alluded to towards the top, that is going to be released, but also released on streaming on Disney Plus the same day that it hits theaters. So this is kind of an example of a blockbuster type film hitting theaters and streaming at the same time. What does that mean for theaters moving forward? I mean, that, I imagine that is going to be a real challenge just to meet the bottom line if they're going to have to compete with folks who have their big screen TVs and great speakers and a nice comfy couch and don't have to pay for their own popcorn.
Right. It's really interesting because before the pandemic, any sign that the studios were going to take their movies to streaming any sooner than a 90-day or 120-day window was met with the most fierce opposition by the theater owners lobbying group, which is called NATO, the National Association of Theater Owners. Boycotts, they just dug in their heels. And I haven't really heard a peep from NATO recently.
They kind of need all the content they can get at this point, right? Have they lost their leverage?
I think temporarily. And I think that the fact that Disney had this corporate reorg where now the streaming is the horse leading the cart, that is extremely telling to me. I think obviously Black Widow is a movie that's going to draw people to theaters, just like F9. You know, they want that, you know, it's sensation. It's a movie about sensationalism. It's a sensationalist experience. And you've got a big screen at home and maybe you've got surround sound or whatever. It's not quite the same thing. So I do think that those movies are going to, unfortunately, those movies and only those movies are going to be still major theatrical hits. And everything else, I think, is going to bleed more and more over to streaming.
All right, so we've highlighted a couple of movies. I know there is a huge list of films coming out this summer. As we said, there's kind of a backlog, so we've got a ton of movies coming out. Lightning round, I want you each to pick one or two more that you're really excited about and tell us why.
One I've seen and one I haven't seen. The one I've seen is called Coda, C-O-D-A. It's a drama that was the hit of the Sundance Film Festival, won the Audience Award, won the Jury Awards. It is filmed in Gloucester, Massachusetts, about a family of fishermen and fisherwomen, all of whom are deaf except for the youngest daughter. And the title stands for Child of Deaf Adults. And Amelia Jones plays the daughter. It was written and directed by Sean Hader, who's a woman who was involved with Orange is the New Black, who grew up in the North Shore area. Marley Matlin plays the mother. Troy Kotsur, who's a lesser known actor, is wonderful as the father. Talk about, representation of marginalized groups. The deaf characters are played by deaf actors in this film. It's very sweet. It's very funny. It's breaking absolutely no new ground. You kind of, once you start watching it, you kind of know where the story's going. It's a sort of coming of age and breaking away kind of storyline. But the performances are so much fun. The local color is, it really captures something of Gloucester. And the working class Gloucester. And the other one that I haven't seen, it's opening the Cannes Film Festival. It's called Annette. It's by a French director named Léos Carax, who is absolutely eccentrically, wonderfully weird. If you ever saw a movie called Holy Motors from a bunch of years ago, that's one of my all-time favorite movies, and it is indescribable. This one stars Adam Driver and Marion Cotillard as a married couple who have a child, Annette, and there's something special about Annette, but I can't tell from the trailer. It's also a musical, and the music is written by the brothers from Sparks, which just had this wonderful documentary made about them by Edgar Wright, the Sparks brothers, Ron and Russell Mayle, who are also quite eccentric and have had a 50-year-long musical career that has never somehow petered out. And they've been trying to get a movie musical made for 50 years. At one point, they were working with Jacques Tati, and that fell through. But finally, they've got a movie coming out. So yes, Adam Driver sings, Marion Cotillard sings. It looks transcendently, wonderfully weird. It's called Annette, and it comes out in late August.
That's great. I'll be looking for that. I'm a sucker for a good movie musical, I'll be honest. Allie, what about you? What else is on your radar for the summer?
So I haven't seen either of these, but there's The Green Knight that comes out at the end of July, starring Dev Patel and Alicia Vikander. It's directed by David Lowery, a director who I've kind of come to love over the last couple of years, especially because he never seems to stick to the same genre twice. And I mean, this is a perfect example of that because it's this Arthurian legend about the Green Knight and a mysterious giant who appears at Camelot. And I think part of why I'm so excited about it too is that it was one of the first films that was pushed back during COVID. And I think everybody just kept waiting and waiting for it to drop or get some kind of, you know, streaming release throughout the last year, and it didn't. So it's built up that anticipation. And also, I mean, the trailer, frankly, just looks kind of odd, very beautiful. But I, despite it being based on these old, you know, Arthurian stories and tales that people might know, I still can't tell what's going to happen in the actual film. And I love going in with a sense of surprise because it doesn't always happen these days.
Thank you. Too many trailers giving away too much. That should be a lesson for Hollywood as well. Let's keep some surprise for the release, right?
Honestly. And I mean, that's the same thing with my second film, which Ty, I think you have seen, 9 Days.
Yes.
It was another one of those films that was having so much buzz out of its premiere at Sundance. And it's one of those films where just by reading a review, I can tell I'm going to love it, which might seem like I'm jumping the gun, but I truly just can get a sense. And it's about 5 souls who are interviewed to see if they can be granted a chance at life on Earth. And in an era of filmmaking where, you know, we're seeing so many regurgitated ideas, we have Marvel, we have Disney, we have sequels, remakes. I love seeing something original.
I've seen it, and it's a lovely movie. Winston Duke is fantastic in it. It's a really big starring role for him. He's sort of the linchpin of the film, and it's visualized in a way that's really quite unusual and lovely. It's obviously a very unique concept, but it's realized with great skill.
Yeah, there's something so compelling about it. Even in a 15-second summary of the premise of the movie, it's enough to say, oh, wow, I've never seen anything like that. That sounds really interesting.
Well, to me, it's one of those ideas that could either fall flat on its face or really take off, and there's probably not much middle ground, and thankfully it doesn't fall flat on its face.
Well, there we go. That's Ty Burr, film critic for the Boston Globe, and Allie Johnson, film critic for CambridgeDay.com and editor-in-chief for TheYoungFolks.com. Thanks so much to both you guys. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, a burst of pure energy and joy to take us into the holiday weekend. I'm Chris Sidorick, and this is Radio Boston. Today we're celebrating summer joy. So we began the hour with Boston Pops conductor Keith Lockhart. He's getting ready for the 4th, where he'll lead the Boston Pops for their first performance in front of a live audience in well over a year. We also took a look ahead at some of the movies coming out this summer that had our expert panel licking their chops and buttering their popcorn. To end the hour, we've got a burst of pure energy and joy. That's musician and performer Dreon doing his rendition of James Brown's Get On Up. The video was posted online by a spectator at a show in Symphony Park in the summer of 2019. Dreon was a Berkeley student then, and it got 1.5 million views on Facebook. It definitely caught our attention. So we invited Dreon to get on up to Studio 3 to talk about his approach to performing, and we want to revisit that conversation now.
You know, so I aim to be, you know, I don't aim to be better than James Brown. I don't aim to be better than Michael Jackson. I aim to be my best. And so when I get out and perform, you know, it's my duty for me to make the audience feel me more than hear me. So it's amazing when I'm in that element and I'm able to channel my inner James Brown or Michael. And so that's really kind of the headspace I go into, you know, even though I don't compare myself to them, that's who I've trained with. I watch the videos and I sit there in the mirror and I imitate. And so that imitation becomes more of an inspiration. And so when I'm performing, I channel that, I go into this place. I don't want to say it's, I don't go somewhere else, but I like to say that I channel everything that I've learned in that moment, and I just give it my all.
You know, it's interesting to hear you talk about channeling, you know, James Brown, Michael Jackson, because when one watches that performance, you can see the influences of a wide variety of performers, musicians in your performance. So who has inspired you?
Whew. So Michael Jackson, Prince, James Brown, Stevie Wonder, a mentor of mine, Percy Beatty, out of Chicago, and many different genres from R&B, gospel, soul, and funk.
So what do they all have in common? What do you love about this wide range of artists?
I like to say the groove. The groove. It's all about, for me, when someone who doesn't do music or someone who isn't as versed in music as we are can move to it and can get with it, that means that there's something there that's a connection, because music is a connector.
Is the groove part of what makes that kind of those musicians, that kind of universal musician, universal, because everybody can experience the groove?
Yes, everybody can experience the groove.
You're going to sing a new song in the studio for us.
Yes.
So tell us about that.
So the song is called For a Change is Coming, and I have a saying that simply says, in order to see a change, you have to be the change. And this song has helped motivate me and inspire me for a very long time. I wrote it 3 years ago when I was in Omaha. And I saw this song as a way to express how the world needs unity. And I really want to unify, you know, the world with my music and with my artistry. And so this song just simply says, keep holding on, keep pressing on until you see a change complete. Keep running this race and keep going all the way until you get there, for a change is coming.
I'm excited to hear it.
Thank you.
Let's do it.
Where is the mother doing all she can to ensure that her daughter never runs to abusive men? Where is the father saying, son, here is the key? Only a real man strives for poise and legacy. I can see how you're feeling now. All hope has gone and bowed down, but the race is given to him who endures. So keep holding on, keep pressing on until you see a change complete. Just keep running.
All right, so you've been here 4 years now.
Yes.
So what have you taken away from your time here in Boston, and how would you characterize the Boston music scene?
It's so eclectic. There's so many different cultures and people that I've met here who have helped me understand, you know, the power of music and how it is a language in itself. And so here I've been able to experiment with so many different things, from country to reggae to gospel to funk to some of the things that I'm comfortable with and some of the things that I'm not comfortable with. Omaha is like R&B, soul, and like jazz, and there's not too much that changes.
Mm-hmm.
And here it's always changing. And so Boston has really given me a chance to broaden my horizons.
How does that change you as an artist? What do you do differently as a singer or a songwriter or a performer now that you've been able to experiment with all these different genres of music?
So I like to consider myself an imitator. So I imitate and I absorb. And once I imitate and I absorb, then it becomes, you know, inspiration. And then it becomes innovation. I eat the meat and spit out the bones, as my uncle would say. I find things that can nurture my gift and nurture my artistry, and then I use it to elevate. So keep holding on, keep pressing on until you see a change complete.
So you're an amazing performer, you're a great singer, you're an inspiring songwriter, and you strive for innovation.
Yes.
Where do you want to be in 10 years?
In 10 years, you know, I hope I can look back on this interview and say, you know, I remember when I did this, because I'm looking to be around the world international. I want to be an international performing and recording artist. And not for the fame. You know, I believe I have a story, and I believe I have I believe I have something that can inspire the world. As I said, I believe that you know, in order to see the change, you have to be the change, and I believe I want to give that message to the world. So I want to tour, I want to release music. I have so much more music, so much more music, but I want to put it all together, and I want to present it to the world. And I would love to be an international recording artist, performing artist, you know, dancing, all of the whole nine.
Well, I have no doubt you have the potential.
Thank you.
That is songwriter and singer Dreon. He's also a student at the Berklee College of Music. Thanks for being at Radio Boston today.
Thank you so much.
Don't you give up, don't you give in, 'cause today is your day.
That was musician and performer Dreon talking with Radio Boston's Tiziana Deering in September 2019. The
end. Oh, until you see a change complete. You gotta keep going. Oh,
that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Paris Alston, Walter Wuthman, and Amanda Beelan. We had help from Ali Audette, Stephen Gelman, and Hafsa Qureshi. Our engineer is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Satesh Hathi. I'm Chris Sitterick. Happy 4th of July weekend, everybody, and hope you'll join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.
So keep running, keep on moving, for a change is coming. Keep on moving, for is coming. Keep on running, keep, for is coming, for a change.